Okay, so I'm going to tell you today a bit about quantum measure theory, and then give an example, I suppose, of how it can be a quite general approach to quantum theory, and in fact, sufficiently general that we could even fit a PR boxes within the framework. So, in a way, my purpose today is twofold. On one hand, I want to spend a good deal of time introducing quantum measure theory as an approach to quantum mechanics. And on the second hand, I want to show how some of the bounds that have been derived for the EPR Bohm experiment can be recast in the language of quantum measure theory. So I want to start out just by making some remarks about the perspective of quantum gravity. So in my mind, one of the important motivations for trying to study the foundations of quantum theory is to be able to apply our understanding then to formulating a theory of quantum gravity. And so what we'd like in the end is some quantum description of the gravitational field. And furthermore, we'd like a framework that allows us to address questions regarding the cosmology, early universe cosmology, when no observers or instruments are present. And so we'd really like to have some framework that allows us to do this. And ideally, we would like to have the ability to describe the microscopic world in some way, so that when we're formulating a theory of quantum gravity, we know what it is that we're actually talking about. We can talk about the actual object that the theory is attempting to describe. And another remark I want to make is that in quantum gravity, the causal structure itself is dynamical. So we don't have some background causal structure onto which we can formulate our quantum ideas. So there's no time, of course, but even in a sense, because of the general covariance of relativity, even the causal structure itself will vary. Is a dynamical variable of the theory, and so what we'd like is something that's sufficiently general to be able to describe this sort of physics. And so the suggestion is that the sum over history approach, which was begun by Feynman, seems like a useful approach to trying to reformulate quantum theory in a manner that's useful then for formulating quantum gravity. In particular, if we want to speak of the causal set approach, so the causal set is a set of atoms of spacetime, if you like, which are endowed with some partial order relation. And they can be described pictorially as a Hasse diagram. So we have just a set of elements, and then there's some relations among them. And it's very much the kinematical structure of the theory is very much in tune with the notion of a history. And so, again, it'd be useful. The obvious approach to quantizing, to writing down a quantum theory for causal sets, seems to be in the direction of sum over histories. Before we get to quantum gravity, of course, any formulation of quantum theory must be able to describe the non-local correlations that arise in the EPR Bohm experiment. So we'll focus primarily on that at this stage. Okay, I wrote here a outline of some of the things. I don't know if we'll have time for all these things, but I intended to start with a example from classical stochastic theory, just to get you in the mood for histories, and then generalize the classical stochastic measure to a quantum measure, and use this to describe the EPR Bohm experiment. And from this, turns out you can write down a Hilbert space from a strongly positive quantum measure, and from this we can derive material inequality, and could give an example of the decoherence functional, which a situation that saturates this bound, and then I'll go on and discuss PR boxes at the end. Okay, so to get you in the mood for histories, I'll start with just a very simple random walk. So imagine that we have a lattice, essentially the integers, except to make life simple, stagger them. Imagine that we have a history, which is simply a path on this lattice, where at each stage, at each moment of time, the path has two possible directions. It can go either to the left or to the right. And for simplicity, let's say that it makes a choice of going to the left or right with probability 1/2. Okay, so I can describe the situation in a formal mathematical way by writing down an object omega, which we call the history space, the space of histories. I will write down the set of subsets of histories as the event space. So in this language, then, an event is simply a subset of the history space. And furthermore, in general, we would have to write down something called the sigma algebra, which is a collection of sets that have a measure assigned to them. To make life simple, we'll keep things finite, and so the sigma algebra will just, in general, will be just equal to the base of histories. So, I mean the. Subsets of the history space, and then. And then, of course, there's a measure. The measure assigns a probability to every element, to every event. Okay, so in this example, then, it's easy to see the space of histories is simply the space of paths of this sort. The space of the event space is the collection of subsets. So, for example, I could take the subset of paths that end at this point, so at time, if you like, t equals 3, and x equals 1, whatever this point is. So there's three paths in this case that arrive at this point at time t equals 3. Okay. So then, in this case, it's very simple. I can write down the measure. Given the simple rule, then the measure is simply for these sets that I've described. So if AI is the set of all histories that end at I equal to each of these spots, say, at t equals 3, then the measure of this will be binomial, will just be the binomial distribution. Okay. And then the last thing I want to say just about this simple example is the question of interpretation. So I've written down a measure, which is just a map. Formally, it's a map from the the set of events to the events to probabilities. What does it mean physically? Well, we can imagine in this situation that there's one history. There's one true history of omega, which is realized. Okay, so there's some special, what really happens in the end is that one of these histories is true and the other, one happens and the others don't. And so, turns out that we can talk about this, and it can be useful to discuss this in a formal way. So if I take, I want to describe this thing in terms of a map, phi, which is a map from the event. So this is, of course, a Boolean algebra. Sometimes called an event algebra. Okay, so we can describe this as a map from the event algebra to Z2, where the elements of Z2 are just the truth value. So if an event occurs, then it gets mapped to 1, and if it doesn't occur, then it gets mapped to 0. So this is a way of describing what actually happens. And this statement here, that one true history, that there's one realized history, this can be described by a particular map phi gamma of A, which is takes the value 1 if gamma is in A and 0 otherwise. Then I want to claim that this map captures this notion that one history is realized. And furthermore, I want to claim that this map is, in fact, a homomorphism. So if I define, if I take two sets, two subsets of my history space, A and B, and I, in my Boolean algebra, I can write down things like intersections of sets. I'm going to, when I write down this, in Z2, I'm going to associate with the intersection here, I'm going to associate with the product. And the symmetric difference of two sets, I'm going to associate with plus and minus. Z2 algebra. So symmetric difference, remember, is this is A and B, then it's this region here. Then I want to claim that this map phi gamma is a homomorphism. Okay, and in fact, it's quite obvious if you just look at the meaning of the definition of phi gamma and this association I've written down for these products. So, so for it to be a homomorphism, it must have be the fact that it preserves multiplication and addition. So if I have some, so the map phi gamma, if gamma is within this symmetric difference, say it's over here, then, so So phi of A, in this case, would be 1, and phi of B would be 0. So 1 plus 0 is 1. Well, if it's not, if it's somewhere else, say it's over here. In this case, gamma is in both A and B. So on the left-hand side, we'd have 0, because gamma is not within this subset. On the right-hand side, we have 1 plus 1, which is 0. So the sum rule is maintained. And then for multiplication, if I have, again, if I had gamma, say, in the intersection, then the left-hand side would be 1, and the right-hand side would be 1 times 1, which is 1. And if gamma were somewhere else, say, in A alone, then it would not be in the intersection. The left-hand side would be 0. And on the right-hand side, I would have 1 times 0, which is 0. Okay. So the reason why I mentioned that this last bit about the interpretation of the measure is that when we get to, so in a moment I'm going to argue that we'll need to generalize this classical probability measure to something that allows for interference between alternatives, something that is fundamentally quantum. But it will turn out that this interpretation is no longer valid in the quantum case. And so a potentially fruitful way to come up with an interpretation of the measure will be to generalize this notion of map from the event algebra to Z2 to something which is not a homomorphism, so to weaken these conditions on this map. Okay, so all right, so let me go ahead and talk about the quantum case. So as I mentioned just a moment ago, so the problem with the classical measure is that it does not allow for interference between alternatives. So there's no way that with simply a classical measure of the sort that I can describe something like the EPR Bohm experiment in terms of a measure, a classical measure on the space of histories. And so what I will do now is generalize, show how we can generalize this notion, something which could work for quantum mechanics. Okay, so talk about a generalized measure. So by a measure now, I mean a map from the event algebra to the non-negative real numbers. In the case of the classical measure, I just had a map to the interval 0, 1. And what I want to do is, given some measure of this sort, I want to construct a hierarchy of symmetric set functions. So the first one I'll call I1 of X, and that's going to be simply the measure itself. I2 of X, Y. So if I have the idea is I have these sets X, Y, Z are meant to be subsets of omega. So I'm going to write down a function now. If you give me a pair of subsets of my history space, I'm going to write down a function, which is the measure of the disjoint union of X and Y minus mu of X. This mu of y. This symbol here means disjoint union. It simply tells you implicitly that X and Y are meant to be non-overlapping sets in this case. Saying third set in my hierarchy, the third function will form in an analogous manner. But now with three sets, I'll take the disjoint union of all three, I'll subtract out the measure of every pair of sets. And then I'll add back in the measure. The individual sets, and I could go on. Okay. So what I end up with is a hierarchy of rules, like so. And I want to define a measure theory. Or a generalized measure at level k in this hierarchy. Satisfies the condition that this symmetric set function ik plus 1 equals 0. And it turns out that this is a hierarchy of generalized measures in the sense that if ik plus 1 equals 0, then this applies that all il equals 0. If I have a rule that where one of these symmetric set functions vanish, then all the higher ones in the hierarchy will also vanish. I'm sorry. All right, sorry. Okay, so to give you some idea of what these mean, so I1 equals 0, the level 0 measure is just a trivial measure, where every set has 0 measure. The level 1 measure, where I2 equals 0, is familiar probability theory. So, and you can identify this as being simply the Kolmogorov sum rule. The interesting case for us will be the level 2 measure with I3 equal to 0. This is what we'll call quantum measure theory. So the defining feature, or the intuitive feature of the level 2 measure is that it allows interference between pairs of histories. Contribution to the measure from pairs of histories, but it disallows some fundamental contribution from triples of histories or any larger numbers of histories. So in general, a measure at level k allows the fundamental interference. K tuples of histories. Okay, so it turns out to be convenient to if we focus on the level two of the quantum measure, it turns out to that it's convenient to express it in terms of a biadditive set function, or otherwise known as a decoherence function.
This started for the last week or so. I think they moved buildings or something, so it's being slowed down. But anyway, there's some experiments in process there. Testing this 3 equals 0 something in different and single photon diffraction. What? They're not trying 3 buildings and interfering which one they go to.
One of the heavy objects in the desk only.
Decoherence function has the property that it's hermitian. So decoherence functional is a set, is a map from pairs of sets of histories into complex numbers in general. It's convenient to write these things as complex numbers. So it has the property that it's hermitian. Additive. So then, in terms of this thing, now the quantum measure at level 2, mu of set X is simply the diagonal elements of the decoherence functional.
And this presumably, so this, what is the statement? Is the statement that if you have quantum measure of this form, then that condition is satisfied necessarily?
Yes. So,
I mean, presumably the reverse statement isn't true.
Which reverse statement?
So the converse statement. So this the statement. Presumably you have the statement that if mu is of that form, then I 3 equals 0.
Yes.
But is the converse true also that if I 3 equals 0, then you can always write mu in that form?
Yes, I believe so.
So both of
right, both of them. So they're equivalent. But the important point is this biadditivity. So D is more convenient because it retains this property that we'd like, that it's additive in its arguments. While this measure is not, so the property of something being additive in its arguments is only valid if this thing vanishes, if I do. So here we've written down something which, even though mu itself is not additive in its arguments, we've written down something which is additive. So this condition is what's leading us to a measure that satisfies the I 3 equals 0.
Is it easy to see the converse? Is it easy to see why any measure satisfying I 3 equals 0 would, could be written in this way?
I'm not sure at the moment.
Okay. I don't think it's entirely straightforward, right? It's not a long calculation, but I don't know any way to just see it by looking at it. Also, it probably should be said that D is not uniquely determined by mu. The imaginary part remains free.
Okay. Well, turns out it's convenient to add one more condition. Out of strong positivity, which says that for every finite collection of possibly non-disjoint subsets, then a matrix MIJ, which is simply P of XI J, positive semi definite. The decoherence functional from ordinary unitary quantum mechanics satisfies this additional condition of strong positivity. Furthermore, so this condition of strong positivity implies ordinary positivity, which we sometimes call weak positivity. So if you have a strongly positive decoherence functional, then it's automatically positive in the original sense. Okay, so I mentioned this already, but just to say it again. So for a quantum measure, if we wrote down such a quantum measure, so we constructed a decoherence functional and perhaps wrote down a measure in this sense, you may ask again, OK, how do we extract meaningful statements from the measure? And in the case of a classical probability measure, we could summarize an interpretation of it in terms of this statement, the one true history of the history space is realized. And I mentioned briefly that this could be written in terms of a function from the event algebra to Z2, to the set of truth tables, which is the homomorphism. And so the proposal for interpreting this quantum measure, or for writing the analogous statement to this, or the quantum measure, would be to weaken this condition of the homomorphism. So for example, I may discard the second addition condition and just retain the multiplication rule for the map. Okay, but that could be a subject of another day. Okay, so I'll move on to your bone. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have a source here. Two detectors. And you can imagine these as being Stern Gerlach analyzers, which each of which has two possible settings. A and A prime. This one has two settings, B and B prime. Okay, and so for each pair of settings, we get 2 times 2 equals 4 experimental probabilities. Okay, so we can write down the space of histories. In terms of just simply the product of a binary sample space, the two possible results for a measurement made by Alice, two possible measurements made by Bob. Okay, and then the idea is we want to say that something that the of course, right, so Alice and Bob need to make two possible measurements. So if we allow for both of those, then there are, in fact, 16 possible experimental probabilities. So here, I didn't say so. Alpha here is meant to be either A or A prime, beta is B or B prime. So the idea to express this in terms of the quantum measure is to write down my history space in terms of the product of all four of these possible experiments. So in a sense, we're giving meaning to the counterfactual histories. We're imagining that Alice and Bob both measure, one way to think of it is we could imagine that Alice and Bob each measure both A and A prime, B and B prime. But are careful not to look at the outcome. So we could in fact realize something like this, we'll call it the joint sample space. So Alice measures A and then carefully recombines the beam and then measures A prime. So likewise, we can realize something like the joint sample space within as actual histories. Okay. And then we can make the statement that, so it's well known that one can derive the CHSFP inequalities from the statement that a system measurements, as I said, so there'll be probabilities for each of these. We can say that this thing admits a joint probability distribution. we can derive these probabilities, probabilities of this is the measurement made by Alice. Measurements. And these here are the outcomes, this A's outcome. B's outcome. Okay. So we say that the system of experimental probabilities admits a joint probability distribution. If we could write down a probability distribution on this sample space, such that these things come out as marginals of the probability distribution, sum out over in which case you sum out over the measurements that are not being made here. Okay, it turns out so this assumption from this assumption one can derive the marginals, the probability distribution. So in the quantum case, we're going to do something similar. So we want to imagine we're going to construct a joint decoherence functional. B on this, again, the joint sample space. So on each, for each argument of the decoherence functional, I can write down the outcome of each of the measurements that are made. So, so this here is the outcome of the A measurement. This is the outcome of A prime. This is the outcome of B. This is the outcome of B prime on the left for the individual history on the left. And then likewise on the right. So what I've written down is the decoherence functional evaluated on this particular history. We get these outcomes. Then it turns out that we can say that the probabilities, the experimental probabilities they're written up above, admit a can be derived from a joint decoherence functional. If the following conditions are satisfied, so let's focus on this first one here. So, so if Alice measures A and Bob measures B, these are the probabilities for the four outcomes that they could get. And so the statement is here, by adding, by putting these delta functions here, we're in fact saying that the measure d coheres on these outcomes. And the probabilities then can be derived from the decoherence function of this expression. There's analogous expressions for the other measurements that can be made. Let me write one more here. So the point is then that the marginals of the decoherence function defined in this way agree with the 16 experimental probabilities. And so if this is the case, then we say that the system of experimental probabilities here admit the joint decoherence functional. And it turns out that from this statement, one can prove that this condition is sufficient to derive the Cyrilson inequality. So if I write down correlators, so in this language now the correlators take this. Turns out that one can prove Cyrilson assumption that experimental probabilities that the joint decoherence functional. The eight inequalities.
Are you also assuming strong positivity or not?
Yes, sorry. Strong positivity. It turns out that as mentioned briefly, it turns out that we have a strongly positive decoherence functional. Then one can write down Hilbert space. The idea here is quite simple. We can write down formal linear combinations of these bit strings. These are the outcomes of four experiments. And the idea is that one can write down an inner product on these things. Using the decoherence function. Which, since it's strongly positive, then I know this thing can act as an inner product. Get a Hilbert space. In general, some of these will be of zero norm. If you get a Hilbert space, what I can do is mod out by the zero norm state. So these things give me some Hilbert space H1. If I can mod out by a set of zero norm states, Hilbert space.
So assuming a strongly positive decoherence functional is it equivalent to usual quantum mechanics in all ways?
Well, that we don't know, but
so it gives you this seriousness inequality. It gives you a lot more too. It sounds like
it gave us the seriousness inequality, and in fact, it also gives us the second inequality, which was proved by Searleson. I don't know if I'll take the time to go through the derivation. Another Searleson inequality in terms of arc signs of the correlators. And it turns out that this, the assumption of a strongly positive decoherence functional is also sufficient to prove the second Searleson inequality. So it's interesting in that then we can derive these inequalities from very general assumptions. So nowhere. All I'm assuming is that there exists some strongly positive decoherence functional from which I can get the experimental probabilities by these marginals. And from that assumption alone, I'm able to derive these inequalities. So in nowhere does unitary quantum mechanics enter into these derivations. We just go ahead and say some words about the error boxes. So it turns out that if I relax the condition of strong positivity, then it turns out that I can go all the way to saturating the this bound here. Write down the PR box. That's the feature that logical bound, of course. turns out that there's eight of these PR box systems of experimental probabilities. Okay, so a convenient way to express this. By writing down, saying that the, so it turns out that because of no signaling, so throughout, I assume that the system of experimental probabilities that we use do not allow for signaling. So it turns out then, in the case of these PR boxes, the no signaling assumption implies that all the probabilities are equal to 1/2, or otherwise would be allowed to do signaling. Otherwise, Alice would be able to signal, send signals to Bob by her choice of the analyzer settings. And so here I'm describing in a concise way. So if Alice measures A and Bob measures P, then this plus sign is saying they both get the same answer. If Alice measures A and Bob measures B prime, they both get the same answer and so on. If Alice measures A prime and Bob measures B prime, then they both get opposite answers, as indicated by this minus sign. And this diagram then shows one PR box. There are four others where I just move this minus sign around on this diagram. And furthermore, you can imagine flipping each of these signs. So I could have a PR box with three minus signs and one plus sign. So this is the compact demonstration that we can write down eight systems of experimental probabilities, which give us this PR box saturation. The down to.
What if you did something like just barely relaxed the restriction that the decoherence function would be positive signal? So in other words, you allowed some eigenvalues that are negative but very small, and you put some kind of bound on that. Could you possibly interpolate between the Cyrilson bound and this saturating bound in some way?
So you want to...
It's just an oddball thing that I'm asking.
You're just asking, like, can I
potentially have... It looks like that's the key for generalizing quantum mechanics, that one statement, and I was wondering if you could go between them.
Yeah, so I think you may not... You have to be careful to satisfy the weak positivity condition if you do something like that. So if you just take some arbitrary violation of strong positivity, you run into danger of violating weak positivity. No longer having quantum measure in that sense.
I'm trying to understand what you said here. Are you saying that you've constructed decoherent or joint decoherence functionals that give you a PR box?
So what I want to say is that if we are relaxed the condition of strong positivity and consider only weak positivity, then it turns out that I can write down a decoherence functional whose marginals give me the probabilities, the experimental probabilities, which would lead to...
Okay, so you haven't explicitly written that down, but you have that somewhere.
You're right.
So, and then the other question was, is the no signaling assumption already implicit in what you've written down over here, or is it an extra assumption?
No signaling is contained within these.
Okay.
So what I wanted to do is draw a diagram showing the results. So, we can write down the eight PR box. So, turns out that if you write down these no signaling probability distributions, they form a polytope. So this was analyzed by they proved that the set of no signaling probability distributions form a polytope with 24 vertices. 8 of these vertices this PR box. Probabilities. And there are 16 vertices, which are a deterministic. So the probabilities are 1 and 0. And these 16 deterministic probabilities saturate the Bell inequalities. So we have 8 vertices which maximally violate the Bell inequalities, and there's 16 more which they're deterministic probability distributions and they saturate the Bell inequalities. So what I could imagine drawing a diagram just to give some feel for what this polytope looks like. So I have a vertex for, say, for each of these PR the corresponding to each of these facets of the polytope, I get each of the facets that saturate the Bell inequalities, I get one of these PR boxes. There's in fact 8 of these PR box guys. So in here I have probability distributions that satisfy the Bell inequalities. Out here, I have one that violates Bell, but nevertheless, there are no signaling. And the Searlson inequality, if I zoom in. So the Searlson inequality is some inequality out here. This is the Bell 2 bound of 2. The first Searlson inequality that I mentioned is 2 root 2 bound of the 4 liters. And the second Searlson inequality that I mentioned that has, in terms of the arc sign, has some curved surface. So this is the what I may have called Searlson 2. So in here we have guys that satisfy material to. And so what we can show is that with the assumption of a strongly positive joint quantum measure, and get anything, we can derive all of these inequalities. We can get the Bell inequalities, the two zeros inequalities. And if we generalize to a weak, if we were willing to abandon strong positivity, then we could go all the way up here. So my point then in closing is that if I recast the EPR Bohm experiment in terms of the language of quantum measure theory, then I can get a new picture on how these various inequalities arise. And it's interesting that, in fact, you can get, it's quite interesting that it seems that nature wants to respect strong positivity, that if I violate strong positivity, then I can get out into this regime which is beyond the Searlson bounds, which are ordinary quantum mechanics. Ordinary quantum mechanics certainly respects the Searlson 1 bound. And so if I'm going to go beyond strongly positive quantum measures, then I can go beyond that. So it seems to be saying perhaps that nature wants to add an additional condition to the quantum measure that it is strongly positive. So it would be nice to have some deeper understanding of why that is or where it comes from. One additional thing I can say is that if we want to be able to take, describe the decoherence functional of two disconnected subsystems, then it turns out that strong positivity is preserved under the forming of a product system from two disconnected systems, but weak positivity is not. So that may be the further reason why we should be expecting to impose strong positivity. Okay, I'll close there. Thank you.
To actually explicitly write down the decoherence functional that gives you the box.
No, I can do that, but I just didn't want to do that. Well, then, just for your amusement, I can write that quickly. So I'll write it. So these are, I'll label the histories by these strings of bits. So as before, this is the outcome of A prime, B prime. And I have the same on the all the entries. So the decoherence functional in general is a 16 by 16 matrix. Um, down the matrix. It's one of these gearboxes. It's like so. It's confusing now. Yeah, I get the idea.
When you fill in this table, what do you get?
What do you want to see? I don't know, I just wanted to say if that was gave me any insights as to what is true.
It has some minus signs in it.
Yes. So. Yes, the positivity condition is that the diagonal elements are non-negative, and if we combine that with the additivity condition, then you can in fact write down this positivity condition for a 16 by 16 matrix translates to 2 to the 16 inequalities. We can write out, keep the minus 2, we can write out. 2 to the 16 inequalities must be satisfied by this.
And isn't the case that for a P, so given a particular PR box state, is it just additivity, so that determines the diagonal elements, right? And then is it the case that the other two conditions uniquely tell you the rest of the diagonal structure? Like, well, the question I'm asking is if I give you a PR box state, is there a unique decoherence functional that gives you that, or did you have freedom in where to put these various constants?
So I could say the way I got there, I didn't actually build this by hand, but put this into a computer and show. I did a linear solver, and I put in all these inequalities and stuff. And that's the dissolving F in these.
So it's a unique solution.
So I believe it is unique.
You put in 64,000 inequalities.
Right. In fact, I asked an undergraduate student to help work with me on this project. I think he was imagining he was going to type in all these quickly once he realized the magnitude of the problem.
These two zeros and bounds, they don't exhaust. There are further ones still, aren't there?
There's a third.
I don't know enough about this.
So it turns out that this Cyrilson 2 bound here can be one can write down, Searlson proves that this thing is equivalent to what may be called an ordinary quantum model for the correlators. So what that means, I believe, is that one can write down operators.
For the correlators as opposed to all the probabilities of things.
Right, such that one can get the correlators out. And there's a third, there's a Searlson 3, which is too horrible to write down. And it turns out that this thing, he proved that this thing is equivalent to an ordinary quantum model for the probabilities. Which is directly what we would like to have. So this is saying that there's a sequence of projection operators.
Is that recall? That third one is somehow essentially an infinite number of inequalities or something. It's completely interactive.
Yes, it's something horrible. But, this thing is saying that the probabilities can be derived from there's the projection operators.
Expectation value of something, you don't necessarily know the probability.
Okay.
And you don't get close to 3 from strong positive.
You probably don't know whether you get close to 3.
Right, so it's still an open question whether one can get a system of experimental probabilities which so from a positive quantum measure whether one can get outside of the Searlson bound. So it's not clear that those are necessary.
There's some oddball linear operators on the tensor product space that have the funny property that if you consider a projection operator on this Hilbert space and a projection operator on that Hilbert space, then, you know, writing trace of the linear operator times the tensor product of two projectors. Just like your formula here, but instead of a quantum state psi, there's something, this other kind of oddball operator that generates proper probability distributions, joint probability distributions. And
it's like a density matrix, but it's not positive or something?
Yeah, it's not positive so it's like a density matrix, but it's not positive semi-definite. Its eigenvalue can be negative. But if you consider the probabilities it gives to localized measurements on both sides, They're positive numbers. So I've always wondered what the signature of that kind of thing is in terms of the correlations that can be achieved.
You mean like a partially transposed state or something?
PPT state. With your analysis, and I think that's called positive one.
I like to call it a locally positive state.
A locally positive state, okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know if.
Well, first off, I wonder if there's an analog to the Searlson bound for such things. And.
I mean, I don't think the set of correlations you can get from such a thing is the same. I mean, it's just a question of how you label your measurement outcomes. So if you allow the freedom to do things like measure sigma x but call the plus one outcome minus one and the minus one outcome plus one, if you allow yourself the relabeling freedom, then you won't get anything different from quantum standard. Yes, because all such operators can be obtained by applying a positive map to one half of an ordinary quantum state, and you could just apply the dual of that map to the measurement operators, local measurement operators, and you'll get some other measurement prescription.
Fine. Well, then, so then what does that say here? Could it be that assuming positive semi-definite might also imply theories about states like that?
Well, all I'm saying is that any Searlson bound that holds in quantum mechanics will hold in theories with such states as well.
Okay. So then, that's good. So then, showing that one gets a Searlson bound under the assumption that the decoherence functional is positive semi-definite.
I mean, I'm assuming that the Searlson bound holds for the Abelians in general as well, which I think is. Like, I mean, Searlson only talked about projective measurements, but.
Coming into the context of David's talk, then, so from the assumption of a positive semi definite decoherence function, we get the Searlson bounds.
Yeah.
But these theories with these other wacky states also get Searlson bounds.
It's not a proof
that you don't get fully quantum mechanics just from the assumption of positive semi-definiteness. But it hints that maybe more has to be proven. Well, not more than has to be proven, but it indicates that there may be other theories that allow positive semi-definite decoherence functions. Mm-hmm.
So Faye was looking for a while, they thought they had found an example of a strong positive decoherence function that couldn't come from ordinary quantum mechanics. Is that right? I forget who that was.
I'm not sure.
Another question.
So I guess one message of what you're saying is that you can get a PR box type correlation, at least in principle, even within the sort of quantum measure where you have I three equals zero. That's not necessarily inconsistent with PR box correlation.
Right.
But presumably, to really establish that, you'd have to build a full theory to show that you could do that. Is that?
No, it's totally true. So this is a weakly positive decoherence functional, which gives us the PR box.
Right.
And you can write down seven others that will give us the other seven PR boxes for this situation where there's two experimenters, two. There's a 2, 2, 2, 7.
Are you asking, like, is there any interesting whole dynamical theory in which you don't have strong positivity that goes up?
Yeah, that.
That goes outside, say, unitary quantum mechanics. So I guess the answer is no. There are examples that do have strong positivity that go beyond unitary quantum mechanics. But I think it's very hard to construct. I mean, for this simple case, you had 64,000 inequalities.
Yeah.
If you wanted to establish strong positivity, you have 16 inequalities to satisfy. So it's much easier, actually, ironically, to satisfy strong positivity than it is to satisfy weak positivity without also satisfying strong positivity. I think that makes it really difficult to build models that have only weak positivity.
Is there any physical intuition as to what strong positivity means? I mean, it looks like a very mathematical condition. Is there any intuitive padding that you can provide?
Well, so it was originally introduced for just this reason of the dimensions, that it's much easier to handle than weak positivity conditions.
So that's
the original one. So. So perhaps these results then are suggesting that maybe it's more accurate than just that kind of convenience.
Right.
For some physical reason.
Well, one might also turn that mathematical convenience into a physical intuition.
I mean, you did mention this other thing. I don't know if that's, I think it's a little more principled.
Yes.
About the composite systems.
Right.
That if each subsystem has a strong positive equivalence functional, then the joint equivalence functional defined in the obvious way is also strongly positive. But if they're only weakly positive, then you don't know. I guess it's false in general. Well, yeah, it's false in general, I think, that the joint equivalence functional is weakly positive. So it behaves poorly under composition. Thank you.